You're my children, and I'll tell you what's good for you? It was not his attitude. His brother wanted class distinctions made more rigid. Paul wanted them eliminated. His brother despised people of color. Paul's attitude, in Mrs. Proper's words, was a genuine feeling of real indignation over the way Negroes were treated. And don't forget, this was at a time when it wasn't fashionable to have such feelings. His brother's attitude toward members of the classes Bella called lower was, like Bella's, markedly patronizing. Perhaps in reaction, Paul, says a friend, was a person who would talk to some menial and be on fine terms with him. He could be impossible, opinionated, arrogant, with people on his own social plane, but he would never, never act like that with anyone who couldn't talk back to him. He was very much aware of the moral responsibility to the lower classes. He was like Robert in that. But his attitude towards these classes was genuinely friendly. He had the ability, which Robert did not, to see people not as members of classes, but as individuals. When they were well into their 70s, the two brothers would be asked about the maids, cooks, and laundresses who had worked in the 46th Street brownstone. Robert could remember exactly one, Old Annie. Asked to tell me something about her, he responded by listing her duties, and stopped. About this woman, whom he saw almost every day of his boyhood, he knew nothing more, not even whether or not she was married. Paul remembered an even dozen who passed through the Moses household at one time or another, and 50 years after he had last seen most of them, he could relate details of their personal lives to an extent that revealed he had talked to them as a friendly equal. Looking back on the youth of these two remarkable brothers, one difference looms large. Robert Moses would bend to his mother's fierce will. Paul Moses would not. Paul says, and relatives agree, that on many issues he and his younger brother shared views that were opposed to Bella's. She was very conservative, and neither of us was, not in the terms of that time. But that in the face of her displeasure, Robert would draw back, hastening to agree with the plain little woman with the steely eyes behind the steel-rimmed spectacles, while Paul would continue to disagree. And Bella Moses, daughter of a woman who bullied underlings, herself a woman who bullied her husband to a point where, to accommodate her own wishes, she forced him to leave the city and the career in which he was happy, was not a woman who brooked disagreement, not even from her own son. Says Mrs. Proper, who saw them together, it was no joke to that mother that she was a Republican and her son was a Democrat. That was apostasy to her. There was, moreover, Paul's romance at Princeton with a Philadelphia girl who was not only beautiful, but first in her class at the University of Pennsylvania, who also had a habit of saying what she thought, and with whom Bella did not get along at all. Relatives say Paul and his mother had a violent falling out over her. Also, at Princeton, Paul became leader of a 1910 version of a Reform Democratic club. Whether or not it was because of the romance and/or the political squabble, Paul left Princeton for 4 years, 4 years about which he never talked. These episodes are some of those obscured by shadows, and returned to major no longer in classics and literature, but in electrical engineering. The conflict between Paul and his mother was more basic than specific issues. It was as fundamental as the fact that when the family discussions grew especially lively, Robert knew where to stop, and his older brother didn't, or if he did, refused to act on the knowledge. Paul was always the same, a maverick, a dissenter, based on this sense of social injustice, Mrs. Proper says. And you only had to meet that mother once to know that that was a house in which very little dissent was tolerated. She never did succeed in running me. That's what made her mad, Paul says. Paul paid a high price for his independence. He wanted to go into public service as much as his younger brother did. But instead, in 1913, the year in which Bella secured for Robert a coveted place in the Bureau of Municipal Research, it was announced to Paul one evening that a partnership had been arranged for him with Kuhn Loeb & Company, the investment banking firm in which Bella's brother-in-law was a partner. Paul declined to follow the pattern his mother had laid down for his life. "What?" he recalls saying. "You don't expect me to go downtown and spend the rest of my life juggling pieces of paper, do you?" "Well, that's what the banking business is, isn't it? Juggling pieces of paper?" He says his father wanted to help him get started in public service, but did not. "Why?" he would say bitterly. "Because father did whatever mother directed. That's why." Shadows cover the next few years of Paul's life. According to several vague accounts, he spent them in South America, returning only when America followed the president he idolized into the war to make the world safe for democracy. At any rate, at a time at which his brother was declining to serve in the war, Paul enlisted in the Navy. Mustered out in November 1918, he was in no worse shape than his brother, who in November 1918, almost 30 years old, dreams of civil service reforms crushed, was working at a humiliating job as little more than a clerk, with no place to turn for work in his chosen field. Looking back at this crucial point in the lives of these two remarkable brothers, another difference, an extension perhaps of Robert's willingness and Paul's unwillingness to bend to the woman they could not face down, looms larger. Robert may have previously refused to compromise with the practical politicians he scorned. But when, at the age of 30, Belle Moskowitz gave him one last chance, he compromised. Having learned he could not beat the Tammany politicians who had crushed him, he was not only willing but eager to join them. He had learned very well indeed the need to compromise. Paul never learned that lesson. Propelled up the Consolidated Edison executive ladder by his engineering brilliance, he was soon assigned, at a salary of $18,000, to find ways of harnessing the vast power of the St. Lawrence River, a plan that would later be thwarted by Al Smith's determination to have the harnessing done by a state power authority. He was hobbled by his refusal to tailor his liberalism to the ultra-conservatism of the utility's executive suite. Once, a top executive asked him if he didn't agree that Woodrow Wilson was a fool. Paul lashed out at him angrily. Robert Moses may have been the idealist who compromised his ideals. Paul Moses was the idealist who didn't. Looking back on the lives of the two Moses boys, one difference looms largest of all. Robert went into public service, a field big enough to allow his unique vision and drive full range, a field in which funds were available on the same scale as his immense dreams, in which his arrogance was in part excused by the public need he was serving, and in part protected by the public powers that devolved on him, so that when he went beyond the law, the power of the state protected him from retaliation. Paul did not go into public service. Eager to do so, he thought he was going to have his chance in 1925, the year after his brother was appointed president of the Long Island State Park Commission, when, he says, his close friend Colonel Frederick Stewart Green, the erudite, urbane head of the State Department of Public Works, offered him a top DPW engineering job. But, Paul says, at the last minute, after everything was set, Green told him that Al Smith had vetoed the appointment without explanation. At the time, Paul told the author with his bitter smile, he did not even suspect that the explanation might have something to do with his brother, whom at the time he considered his friend. Either through a quirk of fate or because of a spirit of competition with his brother, who was so quickly making a name for himself, creating places to swim for the public, Paul purchased a large swimming club in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. At the same time that his brother was making grandiose plans for Jones Beach, Paul was making grandiose plans for his Lanark Pool, planning to turn it into a huge recreational complex by adding additional swimming pools, a huge dance hall, and different restaurants for different pocketbooks. "It would," recalls a friend to whom he enthusiastically broached his ideas, "have been something really unique for the time. He had some imagination, I'll tell you." But imagination on the Moses scale was feasible only on a public scale. Attempting to carry out his plans, Paul spent the pool's revenues as fast as they came in. Robert's grandiose plans cost far more than he had expected, but because his money came from the state treasury, though he spent on an unprecedented scale, overspent his budget, poured funds allocated for an entire bathhouse into its foundation alone, there was always more where that came from. For Paul, there wasn't, particularly after his father died. Emmanuel had helped with his ambitious project, but when, in 1925, he died, he left all his money to his wife. This money was readily available to the younger of her two sons. Although Bella never gave Robert as much as he needed, and he was habitually short on cash, she did support him and his wife and daughters for more than 10 years. When, in 1927, at the age of 38, he was named Secretary of State, it was the first job at which he had ever earned more than a token salary. When, desperate for funds to complete the Jones Beach Causeway, he asked her for a loan of $20,000, she gave it gladly. But for her eldest son, help was limited and grudging, and he was not a man who could beg. Soon, in the midst of a divorce that ended an unhappy marriage, he was being humiliated by the hounding of his Lanark Pool creditors. He was unable even to pay his lawyer, and was sued by him, too. In 1929, there was a reconciliation between Paul and his mother. She asked him to handle her business affairs. Con Ed hired him back on a part-time basis as a consultant, the swimming pool began to earn money, and, appearing nightly in winter at the theater or the opera and at New York's most fashionable restaurants, he was again an elegant, cheerful man about town. Between two men as opinionated as Paul and his brother, there were bound to be frequent arguments, but in the past they had always been friendly. Paul had been a frequent visitor at Robert's home. But since his brother had become a powerful man in state government, Paul felt, his attitude had changed. He no longer, Paul felt, would tolerate anyone, even his brother, disagreeing with him. Looking over the aides his brother had selected, Paul recalled thinking, why, he surrounded himself entirely with behind-kissers. During one heated discussion, his brother adopted an attitude that there was no sense discussing the matter any further since he knew best. By God, Paul said, I believe you're beginning to believe what these behind-kissers tell you. But, Paul says, there was never any particularly momentous clash with his brother. He believed they were still friends. Then, in January or February 1930, Paul and his mother had another falling out. He left in a huff for Philadelphia, staying there for several months. The reason for the falling out is not known, but Paul said that it was no more serious than the other fights he had had with his mother, fights after which they had become reconciled. But this time something new happened, something he would never be able to understand, although he would spend the rest of his life trying to understand it. When he came home to make up with his mother this time, she refused even to see him. The other relatives on whom he dropped in, always so happy to see him in the past, were suddenly cold and distant. They all seemed to think I had done something awful. You could tell from the way they were acting, Paul would say. But I didn't know what the hell it was supposed to be. Much too proud to ask, Paul reacted by avoiding these people who had suddenly turned against him. In March 1930, Bella Moses learned that she had cancer. Paul did not know at first. Whether he ever knew can no longer be determined. According to one story prevalent in the family, Paul never went to see his mother at Mount Sinai Hospital until the last few days before she died. According to another, he had gone earlier, but she had refused to see him. And when, on May 22, 1930, after weeks in which she lay semi-comatose in intense pain, she died of cancer, her will divided her estate between two of her children, Robert and Edna, although Robert's share was bigger than Edna's because to it was added, in effect, $50,000 for the education of his children. To Paul Moses, her eldest son, Bella Moses left only $100,000, and she left it in trust, so that he would receive only the interest from it, never the principal. He had to receive that income through his brother, who was named a trustee of the trust fund, as well as an executor of the will. And there was an additional clause. If Paul ever contested the will, he would automatically lose even the trust fund, whose principal would then be divided between his brother and sister. Paul Moses was to be tortured by his mother's will for the rest of his life. Financially, it changed his life, of course. Previously, his earnings had always been supplemented by gifts from wealthy parents. Now, he would have only the interest, so meager compared to those gifts, on his trust fund. More, he had always had security, the assurance of protection against any real hardships, as well as the assurance that one day a share of his family's wealth would be his. He had been raised among servants and tutors in an atmosphere of snug luxury. He had spent his later life in variations of that atmosphere, and he had never had any reason to doubt that he would be able to live out his life against such a background. Now, suddenly, with a single blow, that security had been stripped from him, irrevocably and forever. It was the Depression. Consulting engineers were a luxury companies could no longer afford. At the time he learned the contents of his mother's will, he had just learned that his retainer from Con Ed would soon be terminated. The swimming pool had not been doing badly, but its income would never be anything near a substitute for that security, even if it, too, was not affected by the Depression. He had saved nothing. There had never been any reason to save. He had always been a man who had much and the prospect of more. Now, all in an instant, at the age of 43, he had nothing. But it was not the financial considerations that hurt Paul most deeply. What his mother's will did to him cannot be computed on any tally sheet. He was to have to live for the rest of his life, not only in straitened circumstances, but with the question of why his mother had forced him into them. 37 years later, a man of 80, he told the author, "I'm trying all this time to divine what was in my mother's mind. What kind of performance was this? Why did she do this thing?" He was to have to live also with alienation from the rest of his family, an alienation that hurt him the more because he could not understand the reason for it. "I don't know what was in their minds," he would say. "What was I supposed to have done that was so terrible? Nothing that I know of, but they seemed to think I had." He was to spend the rest of his life tormented by these questions. And the conclusion that, after years of wondering, he finally reached was one that would not have been illogical to Ansley Wilcox or Judge Clearwater or Paul Kern, or any one of a score of men who had, in one way or another, stood between Robert Moses and something he wanted. His brother, Paul Moses felt, had lied about him when he was not around to defend himself, had poisoned his mother's mind and the minds of other members of his family against him, had exaggerated the details of his divorce and his financial difficulties until they seemed like vicious, unforgivable misdeeds. Paul even had a specific explanation for his mother's decision to virtually cut him out of her estate. "I wasn't present, but I know that Mr. Robert must have had something to do with that," he would tell the author. "There had been another will," Paul would say, "one that had divided his mother's estate equally among her three children." "How do I know?" he would say. "Because I saw it. I saw it several times. I was handling my mother's affairs, you know. It was just a simple thing, divided into three parts after charitable deductions." But Robert Moses had gone to the hospital where his mother lay dying, in a drugged state, Paul said, awaiting an emergency operation that was to be performed that night at 10 o'clock, with a new will in hand, and, at 6 o'clock, had persuaded her to sign it. Paul could even advance a reason for his brother to do such a thing. Robert needed money badly, Paul said. And it was also his brother, Paul said, who was responsible for his difficulty thereafter in obtaining either public or private employment in his profession. One of Paul's charges is demonstrably false. Bella did sign her final will during her last illness in Mount Sinai Hospital, but, according to the date on the will, She signed it on April 4, 1930, 7 weeks before she died. The truth of his charge that his brother lied about him to their mother and their relatives cannot be determined, although it is clear from a series of interviews with surviving relatives that although they regard Paul almost as a criminal, not one of them has any clear idea of what his crime, if there was one, was supposed to be. Cousin Hilda Hellman, for example, says, "He was bad. I think he must have done something pretty awful." "What exactly did he do?" "I really don't have any idea at all," she says. "Well then, why does she think he did anything?" Mrs. Hellman says it was just an impression she had. Asked the source of the impression, she was unable to remember. But at least one other relative, searching her memory, believes it was Robert. Paul insisted that the will be read in the light of Robert's financial situation at the time his mother died, 1930. It was certainly serious. Having been ousted as Secretary of State by Governor Roosevelt in 1929, in 1930, Robert Moses was not earning any salary at all from his remaining jobs. Aside from expenses for which he was entitled to reimbursement, Robert Moses, at the age of 41, had no income at all except what his mother gave him. Now, with their two girls growing up, Barbara was 13 in 1929, Jane 11, Robert Moses' financial situation was complicated by the fact that for him it was unthinkable that his children attend public school, and he therefore had to pay tuition at St. Agnes. The family had a nice place to live. Bella had bought him not only the Babylon summer house, but a brownstone at 261 West 70th Street, but he was so strapped that in 1929 he did not have sufficient funds to pay the next term's tuition, or to make necessary repairs on the Babylon house. Moses had always made a point, both publicly and privately, of insisting that he be a public servant working without pay, refusing Smith's offer of a salary for his Long Island Park Commission job. His disregard for money was a vital part of the public image he had so assiduously cultivated, and the maintenance of this pose in private was no less important to him. But in September 1929, he took what for him was an unprecedented step, in the light of his previous actions, almost a desperate step. On completion of the city trust report he had written as Moreland Commissioner, he submitted a bill for his services of $10,000 plus expenses. This was an unprecedented amount to ask for about 2 months' work, and Roosevelt, of course, would not have been disposed to grant Moses even a reasonable request. He turned Moses down flat. Moses was constantly being offered high-salaried jobs in industry, but that would mean leaving his public career and his public power. In early 1930, with the mother on whom he had always depended for money dying, he needed money desperately. His mother's own resources, moreover, had been shrinking, largely because she had the same extravagant, prodigal attitude toward money as her two sons. Following her husband's death in 1925, she picked up more checks for Madison House. She made generous contributions to other charities, largely ones that produced some sign of physical accomplishment. How Robert Moses felt about this would be revealed later by a remark he made to LaGuardia in a memo about the Children's Aid Society. "Every year my mother contributed more than she could afford to this organization because of her interest in playgrounds." Although about $1,200,000 of her husband's money had been added to her own substantial inheritance, at the beginning of 1929, her net worth was down to little more than $1 million. Sometime during this period, moreover, she told Paul to begin entering future gifts to her children on her books as advances. This, Paul says, was proof of a growing awareness that her resources, while great, were not inexhaustible, and of her determination to be fair in dividing up her estate. The purpose of this method of entering advances, he said, was to make clear that they were advances against her estate, and that, to keep the total amount each child received from her the same, they would be deducted from each one's share of her estate. At the time she died, the advances to Robert Moses on her books totaled $37,200. If there were any advances to Paul, the author could find no record of them. Half of her assets were in stocks. The 1929 crash further slashed her assets. In mid-1929, the worth of her stocks was about $500,000. When her estate was appraised after her death the next year, the value of those stocks was found to have shrunk to $293,649. Her total net worth was down to $690,422. She made no secret of her intention to leave about $50,000 to charity. In Paul's analysis, there no longer existed a fund of family capital large enough so that there was, as the Moses children had always supposed, plenty for everyone. A fair, one-third share of Bella Moses' estate would, after the charitable deduction and inheritance taxes and the subtraction of $37,200, give Robert Moses about $170,000. The income from $170,000 would certainly never amount to enough to support in any decent style a man without a cent of other income with two houses and two children in private school. In Paul's analysis, Robert Moses realized that if he was to continue his precious career and protect his precious image, he needed for himself every cent of his mother's estate that he could get. This, of course, is Paul's analysis. Robert will not discuss it, and there is living no one else who is able to. It is not possible, therefore, for anyone ever to know whether or not Paul's analysis is true, although one part of it seems indisputable. Apart from what he could get from his mother's estate, Robert Moses, 41 years old, had no money to speak of at all. But it is possible to ascertain the truth of Paul Moses' other charge. It is possible to determine whether or not it is true that Robert Moses secretly employed his behind-the-scenes influence in city government to keep his brother from getting jobs he deserved. It is true. Six high officials in that government, six in a position to know, say so. They are Fiorello LaGuardia's corporation counsel, Paul Windels, his comptroller, Joseph D. McGoldrick, his legislative representative, Reuben A. Lazarus, the chairman of the Civil Service Commission, Paul J. Kern, commission member Professor Wallace S. Sayer, and one other official who would talk only on the guarantee of anonymity. Paul, the liberal idealist who had always wanted to work for the public instead of for the giant utilities he felt were defrauding the public, was eager to work for a mayor who felt the same way. He certainly had the qualifications for the work. Anxious to regulate utilities more strictly and to probe the assessment and easement concessions they had obtained from Tammany, the new mayor was having difficulty finding electrical engineers with both expertise and the willingness to antagonize the major employers in the field. Paul possessed both. Highly regarded as an engineer, he was also, McGoldrick adds, kind of an engineer with a cause. He was very suspicious of utilities, like LaGuardia, who was also willing to believe that Con Ed was overcharging the city. And there weren't too many engineers on the liberal side because there was much money to be made working for the utility. Just after LaGuardia's inauguration, Paul had an interview with Windels, who was at the moment looking, on the mayor's behalf, for a commissioner of water supply, gas, and electricity. Windels was impressed. Recalls Kern, "Paul Windels called me and said, 'I want you to show this guy to the mayor. He seems like just what LaGuardia needs.'" Kern was impressed himself. Paul Moses came in and talked about himself, not too modestly, but impressively, and he left his resume with me. His record looked good. Whether as a commissioner or in some other high-level post, Kern recommended to the mayor that Paul be brought into the administration. But there was something standing in Paul's way. Precisely what his brother was saying to LaGuardia about him is not known, although the one reference by Robert to Paul in writing in the mayor's private files consists mainly of a paragraph that could hardly have helped raise questions in the mind of so sharp a lawyer. "While it is nobody's business and purely a family matter, I have not seen my brother for a long time, and I am hardly on speaking terms with him. My only contact with him is in my capacity as a trustee of a fund of which he is the beneficiary." but that he was saying something was obvious. That was quite clear to me. Oh, just from little things LaGuardia dropped, Wendell says. And it also became quite clear to me that for whatever reason, whether Robert made it a condition of his continuation in the administration that his brother not be hired, or whether Robert simply made LaGuardia believe it would be unwise to hire him, he wasn't going to be hired. Shortly, it also became clear to Kern. Having received no reply to his first recommendation that Paul be hired, he decided to press a bit. At one of my half-hour sessions with LaGuardia, he recalls, I took a chance and brought this up, saying, with the shortage of good engineers, what's wrong with this guy? LaGuardia's reply was, don't bother me. I can't have him around as long as Bob is here. The more Windles and Kern saw of Paul, the more their respect for him grew. Remarkable mind, remarkable, Windles says, like the brother, reaching out for a whole problem and pulling the whole thing in at once. Kern, who frequently ate dinner with him, found in him another quality that characterized his brother. He was very good at sizing up people, Kern says. When I was on the Civil Service Commission, I'd often ask him about some guy, and he'd tell me he's no damn good for such and such a reason. And we'd hire him, and sure enough, he'd turn out just that way. Windles saw to it that Paul did get some work, hiring him as an expert witness in condemnation cases involving utilities, and as a consultant to a committee studying transit unification, and later putting him in charge of a 33-man staff reassessing utility properties, at the fee he asked, $50 per day. Listen, Windles says, I checked his qualifications. He was a top engineering consultant. He was worth $50 a day of anybody's money. In fact, during several years in which Paul held this last job, the utilities assessments were raised more than $200 million per year. But these were temporary jobs, and Paul's repeated attempts to obtain a permanent one met with rebuff. He was earning over $12,000 per year from his consulting work for the city, but the Depression was cutting deeper and deeper into the profits from the swimming pool. He needed a job, and he became very bitter over his inability to get one. He did not know, or even suspect, the real reason. Ironically, he thought it was Windles who was keeping him from getting one. Listen, I wasn't asking for a handout, he would say years later. I was recommended by the engineering societies. I knew more about this stuff than anyone else around. I was entitled to at least one of all those jobs. Windles, Lazarus, all those fellows, they were pretty shabby to me. I wanted to get something in public life, and no one would say a word for me. After Windles resigned in 1938, he could not obtain even consulting work. At first, that did not worry him. His services had always been sought by many engineering firms. But now, for some reason he could not understand, even the firms which once sought them most eagerly were totally unwilling to even consider employing him. All through 1939, he hunted for a job in the profession in which he was an acknowledged expert and could not find one. His financial difficulties were compounded because he possessed the Moses prodigality toward money. Remarried to a divorcee with two children, he had undertaken to send them to private school and college. He had moved his new family into an expensive lower Fifth Avenue apartment. Although between 1934 and 1938 he had been earning a substantial income, he had lived to its limit, saving nothing. And he had refused to, perhaps because of his upbringing, had been unable to, put financial limits on the Upper Darby recreational complex that may have been his pitiful attempt to rival Jones Beach. He kept pouring money into the Lanark Pool for modern locker rooms, a dance hall, another restaurant. In 1938, with finances flush, he had put a $33,000 mortgage on the property to finance the construction of an amusement building. As his plans for the building grew larger and larger, so did its cost. In 1939, with the $33,000 spent and the building still not finished, he encumbered the property with a second mortgage. The building was still uncompleted, No receipts were yet being earned by it, and suddenly the receipts earned by the pool and restaurant were being gobbled up by interest payments. One morning, the morning on which the last dreams of Paul Moses' life turned to ashes, there arrived at his office a real estate tax bill that he had no money to pay. The banks, learning of the situation, initiated foreclosure proceedings. He was reduced to borrowing from his wife's aunt, and then from her mother, securing a $12,500 loan from the latter by giving her another mortgage. He desperately needed a good summer. Instead, there was a polio scare in Philadelphia. Few people dared to swim in public pools. The $12,500 melted away. Presented with a $7,500 bill from his attorney, he was unable to pay it. The attorney sued him. His wife's mother had died. In desperation, he had his wife assign the mortgage she had inherited from her to the attorney. He fell behind on federal income tax payments, and interest on them was mounting by the day. Drawing tighter and tighter around this once gay, elegant, free spirit was a net of debts too snarled to permit escape. The marriage melted away with the money. Moving into a cheaper apartment was too agonizing for a man of Paul's pride to contemplate. By the end of 1938, however, he had no choice but to move. He had no money to pay the rent. He had to move in with his in-laws. Using every cent he could lay his hands on to try to save his pool, for a while he moved with some of his elegant suits into a tiny, bare room behind the pool office so that he wouldn't have the expensive commuting costs to Philadelphia, he let other bills slide. He and his wife were being dunned by the butcher, the grocer, by a department store, and even, for $100, by a maid they had let go. He lived on $25 a week, using every other cent the pool earned to pay off its debts, and in some weeks in which a bill or a demand for taxes became too pressing, he was unable to take even the $25. When he had to come to New York in 1939, the year in which his brother moved into the expensive apartment on Gracie Terrace, he slept in a Salvation Army lodging house. Pride made him conceal his poverty so well that acquaintances who, meeting him on the street, noticed that the cuffs on his expensive suits and shirts were ragged, thought this was an affectation on the part of this man who had always cared so much about his appearance. To those who invited him to their homes for dinner, however, it was more difficult to conceal the truth. He might forget and cross his legs, and then friends such as the Propers, who were so kind to him that he would often drop in on them when he happened to be in the neighborhood, saw that there were holes in his socks and in the soles of his shoes. They saw from the way he ate dinner that he hadn't been eating many. Not only did he not have enough money to buy clothes or shoes, they realized, this man, whose brother was host daily at lavish luncheons, did not have enough to buy food. "He got thinner and thinner," Mrs. Proper says. "He was really not getting enough food. We kept him overnight a number of times. I really don't think he had a place to sleep. We offered to lend him some money. He wouldn't take any, not from us at any rate. I used to wish he had. Poor Paul." Genuine friends such as the Propers, moreover, saw changes in Paul that saddened them more than the changes in his appearance. For, to people who remembered his wit and gaiety, the holes that gaped most glaringly now were not the holes in his shoes, but the holes in his spirit. Paul Moses, they realized, was being eaten away by a terrible bitterness. "We had him to some dinner parties, but he was very difficult to handle," Mrs. Proper says. "Bitter, frustrated possibly, opinionated. This was when this Moses side came to the fore, this brushing aside, this arrogance. He was impossible. Paul was his own worst enemy." At the heart of Paul Moses' bitterness was hatred for his brother. Its spark was what Paul felt was injustice in the administration of the $100,000 trust fund of which his brother was a trustee. Their mother had intended that Paul get from that fund an annual income of several thousand dollars per year. But he wasn't getting a cent. The fund's trustees, Robert, Edna, cousin Wilfred Oppenheim, and a bank, had invested Paul's money in guaranteed mortgages, a device common before the Depression, under which a title company, for a fee, guaranteed principal and interest payments and undertook the responsibility of seeing to it that the owner paid his real estate taxes. But two of the three mortgages involved were caught in the crash of the real estate market in New York, during which thousands of owners defaulted on payments, and title companies, unable to meet them all, collapsed. In normal times, the bank, which was managing the trust fund for the trustees, would have received notification of the default in taxes and interest payments from the title companies and would have foreclosed, saving the principal. But in the general confusion, the bank somehow did not check on the tax situation until the owners of the two properties had been in default on taxes and other city charges for more than 2 years. To keep from losing the entire $24,000 investment they had made in one building, the trustees, foreclosing on it, had to sell it for what they could get, $7,500. To keep from losing the $65,000 they had invested in the other, a loft building at 168 the Bowery, they had to pay off $8,000 in taxes and make repairs costing $7,000, which they did by putting a $15,000 second mortgage on it. During the 5 years in which they were paying off this mortgage, the trustees deducted the payments from what Paul would have received. There was nothing left for him. Between October 3, 1935 and August 3, 1939, almost 4 years, he received nothing from his trust fund. By the time the mortgage was paid off, real estate values on the Bowery had plummeted, permanently. The rents earned by the building into which most of his inheritance had been sunk barely met mortgage payments and taxes. His income from the trust was henceforth going to be barely $1,000 a year. If there was negligence involved in the disappearance of his assets, it was on the part of the bank, which had had the responsibility of managing the properties for the trust, not on the part of his brother, who had in fact lost part of his inheritance because he had invested it in guaranteed mortgages. Not even the most prudent investors had foreseen the general collapse of the title companies, which had turned tens of thousands of guaranteed mortgages into all but worthless paper. Paul would probably have understood this if his brother had sat down and explained the situation to him. But his brother wouldn't even talk to him. Once, the few $1,000s a year that the trust fund was supposed to have provided would have seemed like an insignificant sum to Paul Moses. Now, it looked as large as a meal to fill his stomach. It might be the means, the only means, of saving his swimming pool. In an attempt to realize something from the dilapidated Bowery loft that now represented almost his entire inheritance, he thought of two ideas. The bank, he learned, was paying a rental agent about $1,000 per year to collect the rents. Why, he wondered, could the bank not hire him to do the collecting instead and pay him the $1,000? Or, he wondered, why could not the building be sold? He asked its largest tenant if he would be interested in buying. The man said yes and made an offer on the spot, $40,000. Paul was sure he would go higher, and even $40,000, placed in a bank, would return him more than the few $100 the building was netting him annually now. Paul telephoned his brother to present these ideas to him, and heard with astonishment a secretary say that his brother wouldn't talk to him. When he telephoned his brother's home, Mary gave him the same message. When he contacted his sister, Edna said she would do whatever Robert wanted. So did Oppenheim, who, Paul says, seemed to feel I was some sort of criminal or something. So did the bank. Much as he needed the money involved, it wasn't its loss that hurt Paul the most. It was the attitude of his brother. At about this same time, by coincidence, he asked Edna for some pictures or mementos of their parents. She said she did not have anything to spare, not so much as a single photograph. "Oh, I never blamed Edna," Paul was to say. "Whenever something comes up, she asks Mr. Robert what he wants done and then accedes to it." Now he tried to telephone his brother to ask for a photograph. "You'd think they'd let me have a picture, wouldn't you? You'd think they'd let me have something, the oldest one in the family and all. And he still would not come to the phone. He had always been fond of his brother's two daughters, Jane and Barbara. Now, he realized, he was not going to see them at all. And he couldn't imagine why his brother and sister and cousin were treating him this way. For a while, he thought it must be because of his marital difficulties. What right have they to sit in moral judgment on me, an older brother? He said. But that explanation could not account for their attitude. He simply could not imagine what was behind it. In January 1941, Paul received a letter that fanned smoldering hatred into flame, convincing him that the motive behind all his brother's actions had been the desire to wring for himself out of their mother's estate every last dollar he possibly could, even if those dollars had to come out of the pitifully few that Paul was receiving. For the letter, a copy of one from the trustees to the surrogate's court, informed him that Robert Moses was asking that he be paid, out of the trust fund, for his work as trustee. For almost 4 years, from October 3, 1935 to August 3, 1939, Paul Moses had received nothing from the trust fund his mother had left for him. During the remaining months of 1939, he had received $1,144.54. In 1940, $444.18. In 5 years, then, he had received a total of $1,588.72. The letter informed him that the fund's trustees were asking the surrogate's court to approve the payment to them, out of the fund, of commissions for their work as trustees at standard trustee commission rates. Each trustee was asking for $750.90. Together, therefore, they were asking for $3,003.60. At the same time, Oppenheim asked an additional $750 for himself as attorney for the trustees. The wealthy lawyer's request enraged Paul. If it was granted, he would obtain from the trust fund Paul's mother had intended for Paul's support $1,500, just about as much as Paul had received from the fund for the previous 5 years. And Oppenheim was only a cousin. Robert and Edna were brother and sister. They lived comfortably. He often literally did not have enough to eat, but they were attempting to obtain from his trust fund as much money as he had obtained during the previous 5 years. Together, in fact, the trustees were asking for almost $4,000, more than twice as much as Paul had received during those years. And that was not all the information his brother's letter contained. The trustees now felt, it stated, that money Paul had been given in 1933 and 1934, some $3,484, had been given to him by mistake. It should have been applied instead to the bills for repairs and back taxes, and it must now be returned to the trust to build up the principal. Since he did not have any money to return, it would be returned for him. The trustees would add $3,484 to the principal by adding to it payments that would have been made to Paul until that amount was arrived at. Paul realized that his brother and the other trustees were proposing that, after a 4-year period in which he had received from the $100,000 his mother had left him not 1 cent, he should receive not a cent for another 3 years. Paul could take no more. He could not contest the will. The provision that had been placed in it made it too risky for him to do that, but he could contest what the trustees had done with the money left to him in it. Hiring an attorney, he asked the surrogate's court to order the trustees to pay him the thousands of dollars of income from the trust that they had put back to build up the principal, thereby, in his view, throwing good money after bad by pouring funds for repairs into the Bowery property whose value was deteriorating yearly, while at the same time ensuring that he would get no income from the trust. In describing what happened, Paul would tell the author, "It was shifted from a judge who would have been fair to me, a judge who had ruled favorably in a case practically four square with mine, to a judge my brother knew." Court records show that the case was originally scheduled to be heard before James Delahanty, one of the two judges in Manhattan Surrogate's Court, who had indeed, in another case similar to Paul's, held the trustees responsible for the dwindling away of a fund's assets caused by a failure to monitor taxes and mortgage payments. On July 17, 1941, however, Paul's attorney received a notice stating, without explanation, "The issues in the proceeding will be heard before Honorable James A. Foley." James A. Foley, the other Manhattan surrogate, was a key Tammany figure and one of Alfred E. Smith's closest friends. Whether the switch was a matter of court routine or whether Paul was correct in seeing his brother's hand in it cannot be determined. All that is known is what happened at the hearing. While Foley upheld Paul on several minor points, he ruled against him on the key issues, approved payment of the trustees' commissions, and gave Paul a tongue-lashing, saying, in words that caused the blood to rush to Paul's face when he recalled them years later, "You got the whipped cream, now you want the milk." "Now what the hell did that mean?" Paul would say. "What sense was there in that? I don't know to this day." To add a further soupçon of bitterness to Paul's whipped cream, Oppenheim, as a result of extra work he had had to do because of the hearing, increased his fee request from $750 to $1,000, and added on, to be deducted from the meager remainder of his cousin's trust, $38.47 in expenses. Robert Moses had been entrusted by his mother with doling out a pittance to his penniless brother. He took part of that pittance for himself. He took away from a brother who was poor while he was well off, who was walking the streets with holes in his shoes and sleeping in a Salvation Army lodging house, who was almost literally starving for want of a few dollars, $750.90. Legally, he had a right to that commission, but the morality behind the request for it was the morality of Robert Moses. Foley's decision, all the circumstances surrounding the will, was unjust, Paul felt. Most of his mother's money had come to her from her mother, his grandmother, and her husband, his father. His grandmother and father would certainly have wanted him to have a fair share of their money. Was it not unjust that he was not being allowed to have it? And why had she acted so unfairly? "I wasn't present, but I know Mr. Robert must have had something to do with that." Preying on him constantly, moreover, was the feeling that even if his brother had had nothing to do with his mother's injustice, he had compounded that injustice by his later actions. "What right have they to sit in moral judgment on me?" To refuse him even a photograph of his parents? Right or wrong, the feeling deepened into an obsession. Festering within him constantly now was the conviction that he had been the victim of a monstrous injustice at the hands of his own brother. A single talk with his brother might have lanced that infection, but his brother would not grant him the favor of such a talk. The poison from the infection began to soak into his whole personality. He never spoke about the will to friends. He had too much of the need his brother had to relate to others from a commanding position. He needed to pretend that he was set off from others by the fact that he still had money. Few of his friends and acquaintances knew his true circumstances. Windles and Kern and Lazarus would be shocked when they were told after his death of his poverty. "No, I'm sure you must be mistaken about that," says one acquaintance. "I remember quite clearly him telling me he had some sort of independent income, didn't have to work like the rest of us, you know. He said he had bonds, clipped coupons, so he didn't have to pay taxes. And, oh yes, I recall quite clearly that he said he owned some real estate." But Paul talked incessantly about his brother, criticizing his policies and his treatment of the public. "Can't you see the settlement house attitude in everything he does? This attitude of, 'You're my children, and I know what's best for you?'" In hindsight, many of his criticisms would turn out to be perceptive. "You know who it was who first made me realize what this overdependence on highways was going to do to New York?" Lazarus asks. "Paul Moses, that's who." But he put forth the criticisms in a manner so harsh, became so enraged at disagreement, and, when the talk turned to his brother, acted so bitter as to seem almost irrational. It is his way of talking about his brother that makes even more than the usual caution necessary in weighing his charges. Acquaintances who saw him at wide intervals saw a man changing. Lazarus, who had once thought so highly of him, says, "He had a fixation. He hated Bob. Paul was a good engineer, but to get him off balance, all you had to do was mention Bob." As the symptoms of his fixation deepened, it was no longer necessary for someone to bring up Bob's name. Paul seemed to turn every conversation to his brother. Lazarus says Paul became unstable. Kern calls him quite neurotic, capable of violent hatred. Men sitting at a banquet at which his brother was speaking or being honored might notice him standing in the rear of the hall. He was standing in the rear, although they didn't know it, because he could not afford to buy a ticket for a seat, staring up at his brother on the dais with that look of contempt and hatred on his face, and they would nudge their friends and point out the lone, bitter figure standing back in the shadows. This, too, contributed to the impression of an unstable personality, and ironically made it easier for the crowd around City Hall to believe those rumors, the rumors whose source was never identified, that Robert Moses' brother was guilty of some heinous, if unspecified, crime. Fighting to hold on to the Lanark Pool, needing every cent he could scrape up, Paul Moses was trying desperately to find a job now. But he couldn't. As, day after day, a man in his 50s, turning gray, he made the long, humiliating rounds of the job hunter, he found that although he had for years been a high-salaried, highly respected consulting engineer, now not one of the city's engineering consultant firms would offer him any job at all. Perhaps the explanation lay in his altered personality, or in the rumors that followed him. But there were those, engineers who had learned for themselves the hard lesson of what it meant to an engineer in New York to incur the displeasure of Robert Moses, who felt that that was not the real explanation. "You don't really think it was, do you?" asks Ole Singstad, a world-famous engineer who defied Robert Moses once and could not get another job in the city or state for 30 years. Paul did not ask his brother for a job. He would not. But without his knowledge, friends tried to. They tried only once. Carl Proper knew Robert Moses well enough to get an interview without having to say in advance what he wanted to talk about. "Carl only went because it was so obvious that Paul wasn't getting enough to eat. We were worried about his health," Mrs. Proper says. But when Robert realized why Proper had come, Mrs. Proper says, "He was just fit to be tied. He was adamant and uninterested. It was a brush-off." And Paul not only was offered no job by his brother, but did not find it any easier to find work for a private engineering firm, so many of which were supported by the contracts Robert Moses controlled. In 1942, unable to meet the real estate taxes, Paul lost the Lanark Pool. During World War II, Paul obtained a wartime post as superintendent of construction at the U.S. Navy base in Bayonne, New Jersey, dedicated himself to the work so completely that for months he slept on a cot in his office, and became to a large extent his old, competent, incisive self again. But when the war ended, so did the Bayonne job, and Paul, upon his return to New York, couldn't find another one in even the most minor consulting or executive capacity in his field. Why Paul returned to New York, the city in which his brother was in power, instead of trying to make a new life somewhere else, may be explained in part by his age. In 1945, Paul was 58. There may have been another reason also. When the author asked him why, Paul replied, "What? Let him drive me away?" Paul's brother would, after the war, be placing with the private consulting engineering firms he controlled scores of engineers, often on the basis of personal or political considerations. His control of public engineering contracts was a byword in the profession. His brother was an engineer, but his brother could not find a job. It was damned strange that a guy with his ability, a guy who had held really top jobs, couldn't find anything at all, says one engineer. In 1954, Robert Moses would become chairman of the State Power Authority, the body charged with creating hydroelectric power from the St. Lawrence River. This was the field of Paul's particular expertise. He had, in fact, spent months drawing